Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan, and I'm thrilled to share a conversation with the author and activist, Naomi Klein. Firstly, if you like this podcast, I think you'd really enjoy hanging out with me at the Creative Confidence Clinic. This is a new space where I'm talking about writing and reading. Every week I share an essay. This week's is all about the talent trap and how worrying about our talent can make our ego really mean to us. And how curiosity kills the cat of constant self-doubt. There are also book recommendations, conversations, and there's a real sense of community. Team CCC is a lovely little gang. There's also an option to sign up for an annual subscription where you get lots of bonuses, including a monthly masterclass with an industry expert. The amazing Lucy Vine is coming next Sunday. If you've got questions about getting an agent, getting published and sustaining a creative career, you don't want to miss this one. You also get discounts on my writing courses. If you're struggling with social media at the moment, and I really am, the Creative Confidence Clinic is the place where we can all hang out together again. Go to creativeconfidenceclinic.substack.com for more information. Now for Naomi. She's a journalist, author, filmmaker and activist. Her seminal book, No Logo, rocked the world. She writes generous, thoughtful, clear-eyed books about how we can be better humans and how we can learn more about the things that frighten us the most. Her new book, Doppelganger, arose from the fact that she's frequently confused with the academic Naomi Wolf, a confusion that was becoming a professional problem, and it's an exploration of the depersonalisation that we're all going through at the moment and the fear of the double. We talked about the pros and cons of completely unsupervised childhood reading, Philip Roth, Sweet Valley High, and why it's important to be an eternal student.
So it's interesting actually because this just came up. Where I live in Margate, we have a local literary festival which has just had its biggest ever year. And we had the writer Deborah Levy coming. And I don't know if you're familiar, but in her latest novel, August Blue, she writes about the doppelganger and the double. And someone in the audience asked a question and said, have you read Naomi Klein's new book? And have you thought about sort of the concept of doubles as something, I suppose, metaphysical?
What did she say?
Deborah Levy was really curious and excited to read your book. And I think she was very curious about, I suppose, the practical and the spiritual elements of the doppelganger.
Yeah, no, I loved her book. It came out after my book was already finished. There were some things that came out while the book was in galleys and I was able to kind of weave them in, like the remake of Dead Ringers, for instance, starring Rachel Weisz. So it's like, oh, I managed to get that in. I had to make a cut in order to get it into the pages. But I read August Blue, when the book was already completely finished, but really appreciated it. Just so haunting and spare and beautifully captures the uncanniness of the doppelganger experience.
It seems so timely, and I think that's such an interesting thing that happens, and I think we talk about it happening in science and maybe less so in art, and I think this is a combination of the two, of ideas happening and sort of being held by different people simultaneously.
Yeah, it's funny because whenever one is working on a project that requires a lot of focus and really captures one's mind for a few years, it's hard not to see it everywhere. And you don't know, is it just in your head because your eyes are attuned to it now, so you're picking it up, or is it really, you know, are we really experiencing this multiplication of selves? Because the doppelganger is this, the figure of the doppelganger recurs in the history of literature and dating and back to ancient mythology. So it is a continual presence, but it is also true that it seems to surge during particular historical moments as a way to make sense of or look at something that's very hard to look at directly. So you're able to look at an angle, you're able to look at a reflection, right? That was the theory the first theoretical work about doppelgangers was by Otto Rank, the student of Freud's. He wrote this, you know, much cited book-length essay, The Doppelganger. And then that became one of the sources for Freud's essay, The Uncanny, which deals with doppelgangers. But Otto Rank, who later broke with Freud, wrote that essay, and it was a piece of cultural analysis. He was trying to make sense of why the figure of the double was recurring in books and in early films like Student of Prague. And he writes this essay in the very first year of the First World War. So, you know, Europe is falling apart. And his translator speculated, well, maybe this is because the world is falling apart, that there is this interest in doubles. So maybe we are in one of those moments again where we can't look at it directly. So we look at a reflection. We look at it at a slight angle, the double.
I wanted to ask about your... you as a young reader and as a teenage reader, I loved an interview you did with Kirsty Young. I think a couple of interviews, because I think you were on Desert Island Discs with her. I loved hearing you talking about your teenage rebellion in a home where, I don't know if you call it like a house of activists, but where, you know, wanting to explore all the shiny parts of the capitalist H's in a home when that was, you know, not encouraged, and what, you know, everyone around you believed in was very much the opposite of that. And did any of that rebellion extend to your teenage reading at all?
Interesting. Well, probably in like this, reading the Sweet Valley High books and real garbage. But no, back to doubles. I think I was just very fortunate, honestly, that my parents had a huge library. Our basement in our house in Montreal was just lined in books. And I would spend a lot of time down there just pulling books off the shelf that were very inappropriate for me to read at my young age. And I was very unsupervised as a kid. Both my parents were really workaholics. And so nobody was paying attention to what I was reading down in the basement. And that's, you know, they all of their political books were down there. My mom's sort of feminist collection, civil rights collection. So I was reading and anti-war books too. I think one of the more inappropriate books that I read as a kid. Well, there was always Philip Roth. Just to back up a bit, my parents are both Americans. They both went to Stanford for graduate school. My mom was studying film, and my father was studying medicine. And they kind of eloped. My mom was pregnant. My dad was drafted to go to Vietnam, and they moved to Canada and had my brother and then later me. Yeah, there were a lot of anti-war books, they were very much youth of the 60s. So there was Baldwin and Reading Fire Next Time, and all the Philip Roth books. So my mom's from Philadelphia. My father is from Newark, New Jersey, as was Philip Roth. So he went to the same high school as Philip Roth, which was one of our family's claims to fame, like this adjacency to this famous writer.
At the same time?
Roth was 2 years ahead of my father. So Week a Week High, it was the name of the high school in Newark. I don't think my father ever met Philip Roth, but there was this sort of like overclaiming of like he was practically in our family, even though there was no connection whatsoever. But my grandmother loved to brag about Roth, and so So reading like Portnoy's Complaint, Goodbye Columbus, like all the Roth books, Professor of Desire, that was like, that was really inappropriate. Nobody knew that I was reading that when I was 10 or whatever. But I think that my most illicit activity down there was I remember this very vividly. They had, you know, part of them being hippies was like they were trying to raise me differently. And I came across this book called Parent Effectiveness Training, which PET, which was a very trendy child rearing manual of the 60s, where it was this thing where you were supposed to not tell the child, make the child believe that everything was their idea. So what you do is you repeat back everything that they say in a slightly changed, formulation. So it was filled with these mock dialogues, like child, parent. So I study parent effectiveness training and then would just turn the tables on my parents and do the parent part to them when they were. So like if I said like, I can't go to school today. And then in the dialogue, the parent would say, I hear you saying that you can't go to school today. And then I would say, I hear you saying that you can't go to school today. And it would just be this infinite loop of us doing parent effectiveness training on each other. So there were lots of dirty books down there, including Catch 22 by Joseph Heller, which I remember being quite like realized. It really disturbed me how gory this it was. And also just there were lots of scenes of casual sexual assault and so on. That was one book where my mom was like, you have to stop reading that. It's really getting under your skin, because they did catch me reading it because it was putting me in a really bad mood. But parent effectiveness training was probably my greatest rebellion. I don't remember exactly how old I was, probably 8.
Brilliant. And you hacked the system.
I hacked it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting, I think, about Catch 22. And, you know, when you're a very smart, able child who is really, really perceptive, it's complicated, I think, isn't it, with books? Because I love that they, I think, are the one thing where I think it's different. Reading an inappropriate book is somehow different from seeing an inappropriate movie, in a way that you can sort of frame what you're reading in your own experience a little better. There's a way to kind of make room for it and soften it. But even so, I think it's so interesting how we can read things too early and be completely out of our depth. And it's not just sort of, it's not a case of misunderstanding, it's a case of being quite frightened. I was far too young when I read American Psycho, and at first I was like, this is really cool, this guy's in New York and I've never read anything like this, and I love like the short sentences and the sort of the brutality of it, and it felt really edgy and really daring.
How old were you?
I think I would have been 12 or 13.
Yeah, that's not good. I'm sorry to hear that.
I then, next to it on the shelf was Tales of the City by Armistead Maupin, which more than made up for the Bret Easton. And I've still gone back and read Bret Easton Ellis and sort of, I don't know how I feel about him, but I'm always curious about those books. And I think I had a bit of a cool girl reader problem.
Same. Yeah.
No, lots of women who feel a bit this way about Philip Roth as well, with like, oh, this is how the world works, this is the woman I'm supposed to be sophisticated. And John Updike as well, I don't think, the way he wrote about marriages, and I still love those books, but I'm not sure I was adult enough to understand that he was kind of being critical and there was an element of exaggeration and parody.
Yeah, and it is striking that so many of these sort of illicit readings are reading male fantasies of what women are supposed to be at this at this stage when one's own sexuality is developing. I mean, that I think that's the key, right? That it's like the things that enter your brain at the moment that you're even aware of, beginning to be aware of yourself as a sexual being.
It's like parent effectiveness training, isn't it? We are just, I think, searching for manuals.
Yeah, no regrets, you know, but maybe it would have been nice to have more women in the lexicon for me anyway.
I'd love to hear more about James Baldwin, because I know you've mentioned his books in other interviews, and I think that he has got to be a wonderful radical influence to find on your bookshelves at a formative age. This sort of incredibly elegant, bold, mm-hmm. queer voice. I don't think I've ever read anyone like him. And I think that he's a great person to discover in as a younger reader.
Discover and rediscover. You know, it's interesting. I was talking about James Baldwin with a friend where there are some... I mean, certainly Fire Next Time, and, you know, I always loved finding my mom's, you know, like, first editions, you know, like the 1963 edition. Yeah, she just had got it when it was first out. It wasn't like she was a collector or anything.
Oh, wow.
And you know, seeing her name written in it. And I do think that that book had, there's something about the kind of distilled rage of Fire Next Time that was something to aspire to, and particularly when I was writing The Shock Doctrine, that you know, I sometimes say I wrote that book with a clenched fist, holding the pen in it with a clenched fist, because I do write longhand in first draft, and not all my books are written with a clenched fist, but that one mostly was. And it is helpful to return to a voice that was a channeler, really, of collective rage and desire for liberation, and never lost his moral compass. So returning to him again and again, and there's a really wonderful political biography of him by Eddie Glaude that came out a couple years ago called To Begin Again, that is really wonderful as well. But what I was saying, I was talking to a friend about Baldwin, is like, I realize I'm slightly contradicting myself, but there are some writers who, when I read, they help me want to write, you know? I'm like, oh, yeah, they sort of get the juices flowing. And it's like, yeah, okay. But then there are some writers that are so good that they make me feel like, everything's been said. Why am I even trying? And Baldwin is one of those writers sometimes. When I would read him while I was writing Doppelganger, I just would feel like he's written everything. He said it all, particularly about memory. But, you know, then it's just useful to quote him. And I do that a lot.
I'm really curious about how and when writers read, because I think you're so right that there are some writers where I think when it feels like they're being very inclusive and very generous, and they feel quite collaborative. I think Zadie Smith mm-hmm. writes essays this way. And I am, of course, I'm nowhere near as smart as that woman, or even, you know, a thousandth as smart. But, you know, in the happy moments when I'm reading, she makes me feel like she's extending her hand and like we might be. But yet that sense of fear, sort of, when an argument is so beautifully constructed and... Yeah, you do feel that there's sort of, you know, what can possibly be added or changed. But as you say, fabulous to quote.
Yeah. And I think the part of it that feels slightly discouraging is when you're reading truly prophetic voices like Baldwin's and you realize that we didn't listen, you know, that the arguments have been made, you know, for so long. And then it's just the balancing act, because writing is an act of faith. In the power of language, in the power of words, right? And so when you read someone who is saying what needs to be said now in 1963, and, you know, despite the force of their words was not listened to, and the world went in the exact direction that they were warning against, one can feel speechless, right? And one can feel, and by which I mean, one can lose faith in the power of speech and the power of words and the power of language. And that's always the wrestle for me. All of my books are an attempt to find my way out of a feeling of speechlessness. And this most recent one more than any other, because I felt so disoriented by what was happening during the pandemic.
That sense of powerlessness, I think you write about it with such curiosity as well. And I imagine it for anyone to have that case of mistaken identity would be, was it you or was it, it might have been a review I read, sort of this idea that it's a form of vertigo. But I think especially for a writer where all of your work is around controlling how you are expressed and expressing yourself in a very deliberate and measured way.
Yeah, I think I think there's a reason why so many writers have been drawn to this idea of a doubled self. Roth, again, you know, in a way, every one of his novels is a doppelganger novel. You know, there's the Philip Roth character, right? Whether it's Portnoy or Nathan, or later, you know, he would just write his character. I think Professor of Desire was it Professor of Desire? I'm a little confused. I don't think it was. Which one? His main characters would start to become more and more obviously him, in part because his lifelong struggle was that people assumed his characters were him. So he finally seemed to just be playing with the public and go, it's me, you know, and he'd call his characters Philip. And then with Operation Shylock, actually called his main character Philip Roth, who had a doppelganger, Philip Roth. But, you know, Graham Greene wrote about having a doppelganger, and, you know, a real life doppelganger who went around pretending to be Graham Greene, and even got himself arrested for fraud. but I think that, I think part of the reason is there is a lot of ego in writing, and writers do are pretty devoted to their name. And so then the idea that there could be another you out there in the world who the rest of the world thinks is you is a profound challenge to your project. You know, I say at the end of the book, I feel thankful for the experience of this kind of mass confusion, because I think I care too much. I think I cared too much about sort of polishing the self. I think we all do. I think we live in a culture that, you know, has convinced us, you know, with good reason, that optimizing ourselves, branding ourselves, projecting a perfected version of ourselves into the world is our best hope of having any kind of safety or security in this very precarious, brutal economy. And I don't think it's a good trend. You know, I think that focus on the self keeps us from building the kind of collective power that might have a chance of building a better world, of changing things. So I feel grateful to my doppelganger in a weird way. I feel grateful to the confusion, because what it taught me is you can polish yourself up as much as you want, but lots of people, including you, Daisy, you know, are going to think that you're somebody who you really don't want to be. And that is a sort of a message of get over it, you know, just get over yourself. You can't control this. You can't control other people's brains. You can't control how you're perceived in the world. That doesn't mean that you don't care about your work. That doesn't mean that you give up on rigor. And yeah, but it does mean that you sort of take yourself less seriously and focus more on that collective work, on that movement work. So I, you know, I've decided to embrace this as a lesson in unselfing, as Iris Murdoch says.
Well, I was thinking about, you know, you were saying about Baldwin and his prophecies, which we failed to listen to, and again, you know, this bizarre post-Warhol era where we're all broadcasting and we're all constantly thinking about ourselves and trying to curate and control perception. I mean, like, you know, anyone who wants to can do that. And I was thinking, okay, you know, you did warn us about this very, very explicitly and very thoroughly in No Logo, and we failed to listen.
Yeah, but I think it's useful. Like, who is we in that sentence? You know, I don't believe that most of us chose to create the conditions in which it would actually seem to be a rational choice to brand oneself, to think of oneself as a commodity, as a product, as opposed to as a person. I think and that's why I write about systems as opposed to this idea that, you know, we are all actively choosing this out of an array of possible choices. Because, you know, I think we're pushed into it by the logics of a system that have told us that we can't expect a job, we can't expect a pension, that our life is just going to be a series of gigs. So, of course, people reach for this as you know, they look around the culture and they see the people who are successful, and they tend to be people who have mastered the art of self-branding. But I want to turn the focus away from the individuals who make that choice and towards the system that is pushing so many of us into the conclusion that this is the only way that we can have any kind of security for ourselves and our families, because I think we should have better choices. And doppelgangers are also useful in thinking about the roads not taken. You know, that's what Freud said about why we're so, one of the reasons we're drawn to the figure of the doppelganger is that we all know that the life we have now is only one of many possible lives we could have had. If the circumstances were different, if the choices we made were different, if the choices other people made were different. That's the sort of, I think, the lure of the multiverse story, right? And there's more and more attraction to that, and we're seeing more and more of it in the culture. So I think we can take other roads, but not if we're thinking about it just as individuals. It's only as collectives that we can get to another set of choices. And that's where I think we need to embrace the project of unselfing, not as a sort of individualistic sort of Buddhist exercise of reaching, enlightenment, but as a collective process of reaching towards one another and building some kind of collective power that is the only thing that's going to get us better choices than the individual branded self. But yeah, I did write about this in No Logo. I could never have imagined how far it would go. But, I was thinking about that book ahead of this conversation and what books influenced me and to write it, to write in that way. And I remembered this book that I read when I was in university, when I was a student journalist, which was a collection of columns by my favorite Village Voice columnist, Lisa Jones, who she's co-written some books with Spike Lee, but she had a column in the Village Voice. I was a student journalist in the 90s, and we were all obsessed with the Village Voice. That was our career goal, to get a job at the Village Voice. My student newspaper had a subscription, and we were all just so excited when it came in. And I loved, Lisa Jones had this column called Skin Trade, where she wrote about race and gender in this very kind of pop culture friendly way that felt really important to me. Her columns were collected into an anthology called Bulletproof Diva. I think it was Tales of Sex, Race, and Hair. And one of the first lines was, "Style is political, of course." And that was
that's really good,
right? And anyway, that, the way I wrote No Logo, which was like inside the culture of being drawn to the shiny things, but still reserving the right to deconstruct them, I feel like I owe a lot to her.
I've not heard of that book, but I'm going to try and track down a copy because it sounds incredible. It makes me think of that. I really love, I think it's called Crazy Salad and Scribble Scribble in Nora Ephron's Esquire anthology. And I think I just remember being so thrilled by the breadth of her remit, I suppose. And I don't think those are necessarily the pieces that she's remembered for, but that she sort of does manage to watch and observe, and it is that, I suppose, the wallflower at the orgy thing where she's not putting herself on the page, but she is in her observations, and in that sense of the voice and the eye, I think, is so powerful. And I think as well that, I don't know how you feel about this, for ambitious women, and I think I heard you say it in an interview, thinking about this idea of being a sort of a glamorous foreign correspondent, that it's writing is what means we can travel. And I think in the books I read, there are lots of, more novels and things, but at a time, when women being sort of in the workplace and participating in capitalism and having autonomy and money is so new, writing seemed to be one of the very few ways to do it. Writing and sex.
Yeah. I was, another book that I remembered from the basement from my mom's collection was Arianna Fallaci's Interviews with History. This huge, it was a big, thick book. And she was a, I guess, kind of foreign correspondent, right? I mean, she was interviewing Arafat. She was interviewing all of these historical figures. I mean, I was reading a little bit about Falashi's later politics, which were like virulently anti-Islam. So don't take this as a full-throated endorsement of her politics. But as a teen, this idea of this glamorous Italian sort of war correspondent, but like going into these kind of conflict zones, getting interviews with history, you know, and the book was just transcripts of her interviews that she did for, I forget which Italian magazine she worked for, but she was in there. And that made an impression on me. Even just the title, Interviews with History. But yeah, that was another one of my inappropriate readings as a teen.
Oh, that sounds thrilling. And I think there's a certain amount of fearlessness as well. You know, seeing this person putting themselves in really challenging situations.
And I didn't, you know, I'm a nonfiction writer, and it was nonfiction that that captured my imagination as a kid. Poetry as well, but nonfiction. There was another journalist, completely different category. But I was always looking for people who were doing this political work but having fun doing it. Because the thing that troubled me about my parents' politics was that it felt dour and scolding. I hope my mom doesn't hear this. but I wanted, you know, I was looking for a feminism, looking for a left that held the contradictions of the attractions to, that wasn't on the outside shaking its finger saying this is bad, because I felt really judged by that. And you know, that's what somebody like Lisa Jones, you know, was to me. And the other person who I just loved and who unlocked something in me and wanting to be a certain kind of political writer was Molly Ivins, who was from Texas. And she would just write about the absurdity of Texas politics. And she was like an early capturer of the extreme stupidity of George W. Bush, because she was a Texan. And so she was writing about him when he was governor. She would just call him W. And she just captured just the inanity of Texan politics in this very, very funny way. And I would just love reading her columns, which would be, you know, were collected into various anthologies. So yeah, that shorter form writing had a big influence on me.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
We'll be back with Naomi soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week. I've chosen Nina Stibbe's new book, Went to London, Took the Dog. It's a diary of Nina's sabbatical in literary London. She becomes Deborah Mogok's lodger, replacing Savnam Sangera. I just picked up the book to look for one of my favourite funny bits and immediately got blissfully lost because every line is funny. Buy it for someone with great taste for Christmas. Secretly read it first, then drop it in the bath and buy another copy. I love it. You'll love it. In the spirit of full disclosure, I should admit that producer Dale and I are on page 20. Went to London, took the dog, is published by Picador, and out now. Now back to Naomi.
Just looking up a book which I've just read and I loved it so much. It's the memoir of a gossip columnist called Susan, I think you pronounce the name, Mulcahy? M-U-L-C-A-H-Y. Because my lips are sealed.
Oh, is that what it's called? Yeah, that's a good title.
Yes. So she ends up editing Page Six in the New York Post. But she's there, again, I think it's late 70s, early 80s, and it's when Rupert Murdoch is just in there sort of building his empire. And she said the whole building is just full of very, like, sweary Australians. But also it's the beginning of Donald Trump as the ultimate self-promoter, sort of begging to be in the column. And she's, I loved it so much because she sort of says, you know, everyone thinks what I do is so frothy and I'm not going to contradict them. Of course it is. Gossip is supposed to be fun. This is where people turn when they want to have fun. But at the same time, the information that was kind of leaking through, I think she had the advantage of often being dismissed as a woman and as a woman who edited like the fun page, which she had lots of power and was sort of privy to lots of information, but also was, I think, able to start sort of putting the pieces together and seeing what these monstrous men might become.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think there is definitely something about knowing them when they were really young and before they were polished and before they became these really powerful figures. Yeah, Ivan's definitely had that. I mean, the other thing that I looked for as a young writer was just like a sense of the, you know, the ability to combine a political project with some kind of innovation in form. So you know, even though The Shock Doctrine is a, you know, more conventional nonfiction book, it has this sort of the metaphor of shock runs through it, right? Whether economic or bodily shocks. And I think one of the big influences for that was reading Eduardo Galeano, in particular Open Veins of Latin America, which is, it's very, you know, innovatively told history, in these sort of little vignettes. And it feel, you know, he brought the energy of a true storyteller to historical work, and it's this combination. You know, it feels like it they feel like parables, really. And he, in the introduction, I think to that book, he talks about how he never respected the border guards that police the boundaries between the genres, which is something that's really stayed with me. So that's, you know, another kind of way into it. So it's not, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, to me, it's not always about being funny, although being funny sometimes is what's appropriate, or having a strong sense of the absurd. But just trying to be writerly. Like not forgetting that this is not just medicine, this is reading, this is text. And I do think that sometimes on the left, because the content is so worthy, we think we don't have to care about that. But we do. We have to make people want to read our books.
It's interesting because this came up at the Literary Festival as well. And my friend Yomi Adegoke has just written a brilliant book called The List, which is a novel, and it's about what happens when a pair of very known professional influencers reports emerge where the guy is a bad guy. And there's a list of sort of abusive men that circulates, and it's an amazing book. But Yomi is a journalist and said she initially wanted to write a serious piece of journalism about sexism and about exploitation and about sort of, you know, where we were in, I mean, I know we're never going to be post Me Too, but in the wake of what happened a few years ago. It took a while in her, you know, she'd sort of written like a nonfiction book before that had been very, very successful, but realizing that she was allowed to write something that was fun and entertaining, and it could be about something very serious, and those serious parts could really, you know, resonate and you know, be heard and inspire people to action. But that could be part of a piece that had, you know, those funny moments and those absurd moments in it as well.
Yeah, I would love to try that sometimes. Sometime. I mean, I've talked about this before, but this book, my most recent book, I worked with a writing teacher to find another kind to, you know, I guess a more literary voice. You know, Doppelganger's very much not conventional nonfiction. It's more creative nonfiction, and it's a more experimental style. And yeah, I worked with this wonderful writing teacher, Harriet Clark, who's a novelist and taught creative writing at Stanford for years. But it did make me think that it might be fun to try my hand at, you know, at fiction. So I'm inching towards it. We'll see what happens.
Oh, that's mm-hmm. so exciting. Mm-hmm. And I love that as well, because I hadn't heard about it. And I think to be a seasoned writer, you know, you have written so many books and they've had, you know, sort of acclaim on every level. And to then go back and think, could someone else teach me another way of doing this? I think it's interesting. Maybe... Yeah. I think that kind of comes back to the ego. I think that it's a really inspiring thing to be, you know, at such a high point in your career and say, I think I could learn something. I think I could do this differently, and I'm going to ask someone for help.
I'm so glad I did it. And I think that it was, frankly, one of the strange gifts of the pandemic. Because my life has been so filled with travel since I was in my 20s that taking a course was just impossible. Like I could never have done it. I could never have stuck with it because I was always running around too much. And being grounded for a few years, I suddenly realized, well, I could, because it had been in the back of my mind that I'd wanted to do this. Because I didn't study creative writing. I studied literature and I studied philosophy, but I didn't ever do a creative writing course. And then I realized, well, actually, I'm not going anywhere for maybe probably I don't have anything on my schedule for the next year because nobody was booking any events and so on. Yeah, I was teaching university by Zoom. But I had time in a way that I had not had before. And I'm really glad that I did this. I owe it to my friend V, formerly E. Wenzler, who introduced me to Harriet. Yeah, went back to school. I had that feeling of being a foolish undergrad, which I hadn't had since I took Spanish, in my 30s, because we were living in Argentina to make a film there. There's nothing more humbling than going back to school. And it's also good for me as somebody who teaches undergrads to have had that experience. I think it made me a better teacher.
Oh, that's interesting. And that makes sense as well, because I think it's really difficult, isn't it, to explain how something is. And obviously, you know, you do it and do it well. And I'm, you know, very jealous of the undergrads who have you as a teacher. But I teach some creative writing and I've been learning about creative writing as I go and suddenly noticing all of the things that I just have been doing without thinking actually do need some explanation. I think it's a really, I don't want to sound like Kanye. I was going to say it's a humbling process, but it is to think about how the enormous skill required to explain something that you do and how different that is from doing it.
Exactly. Yeah. Especially if you didn't, if it came to you more intuitively as opposed to, you going to the Iowa Writers' Workshop and, you know, having that kind of training.
You mentioned reading poets when you were younger. I'd love to hear about the poetry you read.
Because my mom was involved in the second wave feminist movement, a lot of the poems I found on her bookshelf were like March Piercy, Susan Griffin, Maya Angelou. You know, I think that those were probably pretty important for me as a teen. Lately, I've been really taken with Jory Graham's poetry. Her latest is Towards 2040, I believe is the name. And it's really grappling with this, with the climate crisis and technology and mortality. And she writes about caring for her mother on her deathbed, mediated by technology, like cameras that allow her to be in the room when she can't physically be in the room. I think, frankly, it's too rare for our literary giants to grapple with the weight of our moment in history right now, to really try to grapple with extinction and being on the knife edge of a collapse of a habitable planet at the same time as we're doing things with technology that are utterly destabilizing to our sense of self. And, you know, she does that with poetry. You know, my students, one of the books we read in my climate feelings course, it's actually called ecological affect, but I always tell them in the first class that that's just a fancy word for saying climate feelings. You know, I call it climate feelings because I want to broaden the parameters of what kinds of feelings the natural world evokes in us, that it isn't, you know, we've prescribed anxiety as one of the emotions we feel in the face of the climate crisis, or terror. I organized the seminar by emotion. It gets a little bit messy, but one of the emotions is delight. and reread Ross Gay's The Book of Delights, which is just the most amazing book of poetry, where he created this discipline for himself where every day he would write a poem that captured the feeling of delight. And there's one that's just about traveling with a tomato plant. It's just the students love and I love so much. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't believe we will do what is necessary in the face of any of the crises we face unless we are very much in touch with feelings of love and cherishing about what needs to be protected. If we're only driven by fear and rage, we will pickle in it and turn inwards. But if we are able to really open up portals that connect us to how much we love one another and the natural world, and, you know, when I say one another, I mean beyond species, then we'll be nourished by that. We'll, like, those will be the roots that, you know, keep us in this in a good way. Ross Gay is really important for that. Return to him often. Highly recommend Book of Delights. My students love it so much.
I'm so happy that you mentioned him, because I had a wonderful interview with him and I'd not thought of that book in so long. Mm-hmm. And I really want to go back and visit it. And I think that's so true that we forget. I think it's so easy to be so drained and burned out by that dread, and we need to be filled
nourished
with something.
Need to be
and
nourished
by something.
And he is so nourishing. And we can't stay in that register all the time, but we need to. Mm. We need access to it. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. They also love, you know, we read Keogh McClear, Birds Aren't Life. And I'm going to assign her most recent memoir, which is Unearthing. These two books, Birds Aren't Life and Unearthing, are stories around loss and care and caring for aging parents and losing parents and losing who you thought was your parent. And it turns out maybe they're not your blood parent, which is what unearthing, you know, that's what it starts with. But it becomes this sort of celebration of entanglement and questions around what is kinship and what is family, and really expanding that sort of circle of relations in this incredibly beautiful and generative way. Birds Aren't Life is really just a celebration of kind of fine attention that birding offered her in a moment of grief. Anyway, some of
that
my favorites.
Beautiful. They're wonderful, wonderful recommendations. And I don't know those books, and I'm going to seek them out, because I think that's such a fascinating topic as well. Our attention as a resource and where we place it.
Oh my God, yeah.
And how books hold it, I suppose. And how I'm so aware, you know, as a reader as well. And, you know, you mentioned about sort of being a teenage reader reading like trashy books like Sweet Valley High. But I often think, you know, I'd love to be mostly reading the books that nourish me. And I suppose this kind of comes back to that, things being very worthy and earnest and good. And I often think that a trashy book that's fun and that really is gripping and engaging, that can be so much more nourishing than so many of the other things that we spend our attention on.
You know, or a book like Demon Copperhead, which doesn't need me to celebrate it, but it's still, you know, on my mind, but Barbara Kingsolver's latest, just absolute masterpiece, is, you know, it shows that anything and anyone you give your true attention to, you know, as an artist, that it can elevate anyone in any circumstance. And that the violence is just giving oneself permission to turn away, give no attention, give no care. And she's, you know, she, her subject matter are the people, the group of people in the United States for whom it has been so long socially acceptable to just dismiss as white trash, as rednecks, and to just be like, this is the one group that I don't have to give my attention to, you know, even on the left, right, where we are grappling with so many forms of othering and dismissal. And these are her people, and she is absolutely bound and determined to say every one of these, you know, everyone deserves our attention, you know, which doesn't mean that there's no accountability and that everybody is, you know, nobody's a saint in that book, right? But there are power dynamics, and there are people who are predators, and there are people who are prey, but everybody's worthy of her attention. And that, you know, that light that she shines is just so, I think, such a healing force and just extraordinary. Yeah, I love that book so much, love her so much.
It's rich territory for any novelist too, I think, to, you know, look for the unsung and the unseen. And I don't want to get too far into the weeds of kind of, you know, who's allowed to write what. And I think as a reader, for sure, I would always rather that someone be writing about their own experience than another writer sort of comes along and says, here's how it is, and I'm going to tell, and I'm going to speak for these people because they can't speak. I think that is also a problem that lies much more with publishing than with writers, that it's, I think, the responsibility of publishers to make sure that everyone is getting to tell their stories. But also, there are so many tiny, tiny tales that we might miss. And the books I love the most are the ones that take that really, really close view. And they're not necessarily writing about the big and the grand and dramatic, but taking those smaller stories and exploring them. I just interviewed the writer Katrina Diamond, who writes quite sort of intense, and I'd say sort of violent, visceral thrillers, but they've all got a real feminist edge. And she started because she read a story in a newspaper about domestic violence, and she was so horrified and angry about it. She wanted to rewrite it in a way where a woman could triumph and a woman could see justice. And I think writing our own realities isn't helping, but maybe in a subtle way it is. Maybe by bringing that version into the world and having people read that and draw it in, it does start to kind of almost change the spiritual and emotional water level in a way.
I think it does. It's a piece of it. It's not the whole of it. I mean, we have to believe in it. I don't think somebody like Kingsolver, who does this, just is so committed to the work of humanization, would argue that that's the whole job. I think she believes in political and economic responses as well, but maybe unless we see each other as humans, we're not going to be able to do that work. And, you know, we are in a moment of just such extreme dehumanization of one another. You know, one book that I've thinking about that I've just ordered is Minor Detail by Adanya Shibley, which I hadn't read. But this is, you know, she's a Palestinian novelist who was going to be getting this, important prize at the Frankfurt Book Fair, and it was canceled because it was seen as too,
contentious.
And this is precisely the moment when they, I think that was such a shameful decision. And I, signed that letter. There's so many letters floating around, signed the letter standing with her. But I hadn't read the novel, and, it's making its way to me at the moment. I've just ordered it now that I'm back from book tour. We need to be reading those stories of humanization because they're needed more than ever.
Mm, absolutely. I think that is such a powerful place to come to a stop. Well, I was going to ask you what you're about to read, and now I know. And, I'm just thinking shamefully, I don't know that I ever have read any Palestinian writers, and you're so right, now is the time, absolutely, to read those stories. It's been such a pleasure having this conversation with you. I can't thank you enough. And I feel smarter. I don't think I am smarter, but I feel smarter. And that's what kind of, but I'm definitely, definitely much, much smarter and maybe more human having read Doppelganger. And I'm sure that a lot of the people listening have already, absorbed it and been gripped by it, because it is gripping and it is such a joy to read.
I must say that that's such a compliment coming from you. Thank you so much.
Huge thanks to Naomi. Doppelganger is published by Penguin and out now. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for Neil Alaska and created by Dale Shaw and me, Daisy Buchanan. To see all the books Naomi mentioned, go to acast.com/booked, and you can shop a selection on our page at bookshop.org. Find us and follow us on social media at MyBooked, and if you're feeling especially generous, we would hugely appreciate a 5-star review. As well as helping us, you could be helping a new listener to discover the podcast and their new favourite book. Finally, I leave you with this from Zadie Smith. The very reason I write is so that I might not sleepwalk through my entire life. See you next time.
The softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.